Supreme Ray, your host at the One Soccer Nation podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Antonio Di Giane. Antonio is the head of football economics and strategy at Football Benchmark. Antonio, thank you so much for taking the time today. How's it going?
Hello, Karim. Thank you for hosting me.
Absolutely. So for the viewers, what is Football Benchmark?
We are a spin-off of KPMG. This is the short answer. The longer answer is that we represented sports advisory practice within the whole KPMG global network. KPMG, for those who don't know, is one of the so-called big four of consultancy in the world. So the sports advisory practice meant we were the only ones exclusively and solely dedicated to sports advisory projects and engagements. In April 2022, so almost 2 years ago now, we did a spin-off and we started to operate separately from the Big Four environment. So the whole team, the whole practice, left KPMG. A brand new company was set up. We all joined this new company, and now we basically continue doing what we were doing before at KPMG, but again, on our own.
Understood. I've never asked this question before, but I just thought about it now, and I feel like that it would be a good one for our listeners to know is, you know, learn a bit more about who we're speaking to. So who is Antonio Di Giane?
Do you want me to share a bit my journey to like from student time to my professional experience? Is that something that you think would be interesting?
Yeah, I think that would be great context, you know, very summarized, where you grew up, where you're from, what you studied, and how you got into the beautiful game.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'm Italian, as many of you will understand from my accent. I was born in southern Italy. That's where I grew up. Always nurtured my passion about football or soccer, I should say, as a majority of young kids in Italy have. I started playing. I started watching matches. I started attending matches whenever I could, and then I started to develop my desire, my dream back then to at some point, I didn't know really how, start working in the football industry. So after high school, I decided to go to university in Siena, which is in Tuscany, so relatively far. Relatively far from my hometown, approximately, let's say, 1,000 kilometers. So for Italian, let's say, standards, that's quite a lot, to study economics. So I did my bachelor, and my drive was to get graduated in economics to help me jump into the football industry. Of course, the more I studied, the more I started to understand also what could be what I liked about the subjects, what I didn't like about the subjects, a bit like everyone else when we start a faculty where we really don't even know even what to expect somehow, right? So we need to take this decision in Italy when we are 19. So we are still pretty young, although it's a very crucial decision for our life and our career. So I did my bachelor, and then I did my what is called in Italy specialization. So after the first 3 years, you have 2 years. During these 2 years, I took the decision to also do my Erasmus program. It's an exchange program at student level. Then I went to Spain in Valencia, and I took the chance to learn Spanish. I already learned English during my high school times privately, and then after finishing also this specialization, so these other 2 years after the bachelor, I decided to study for a further year. This time I enrolled. And I got accepted at a master in London, Master of Science in London. The master was sport management and the business of football. So I really started to even steer more towards the specific industry rather than just staying with my, let's say, general economics and management studies. So after at the end of my master's in London, I was looking for a job a bit like everyone at that stage, sent my CV around, especially in Europe, London, but also continental Europe. And I got a call from the former partner of the KPMG Sports Advisory Practice, which used to be based in Budapest, Hungary. So I would never expect to move from London to a city like Budapest, honestly. But the opportunity in a big four, again, KPMG, and in a specific sector like sport, and specifically football, made me take the decision very, very easily. Of course, salary was an entry salary, so the decision was not really driven by money, I would say, but still by the opportunity. So I packed everything, and in 2 weeks, literally, I moved to Budapest. I stayed there for 7 years until the spin-off from KPMG occurred. And then after the spin-off from KPMG, where we all joined, as I said, the new company, and now we are called Football Benchmark, I decided to relocate and to work remotely from Madrid, where I'm currently based.
Amazing. So, I mean, I've heard of Budapest. I heard it's really nice down there.
It's a very nice city. It's a very nice city, very beautiful. People call it the Paris of the East, like Eastern Europe. So that tells you a bit about the beauty. It's really lovely with the Danube River, the biggest river in Europe. So it's I would say definitely a must see. At some point, I felt again after almost 7 years I lived there, I felt I wanted some new challenge, some new experience. So I wanted to keep the job in this new venture, but I wanted to go live somewhere else. And one of the goals was also, and is also, to develop more the business in the Spanish market.
Understood. You speak English, Spanish, Italian. Is there any other languages that you speak?
No, not really. Just a very, very basic of French, but not really any, let's say, high level.
Can you say I love football in those three different languages or four?
I love football. I love football. Amo il football. Amo il calcio. J'aime le football in French, I presume.
That's amazing. Speaking different languages is always nice, and
makes you feel the world smaller. I think, Karim, this is what I always thought when I was a kid. I was a big fan of geography, so capital of the world, capitals of the world, and so on and so forth. And I always thought, you know, if I learn a language that allows me to travel to, I don't know, Sweden or Thailand or Chile or wherever else, that would allow me to travel there, or why not even to live there with no issues. And at the end of the day, these three languages cover, I would say, most of the most common spoken languages in the world, right? If we exclude Mandarin or, surely French is another widely spoken language, especially also in a region such Africa. I would say that I could kind of cover many, many areas of the world with three languages.
Absolutely. Antonio, with your extensive experience in football advisory, what inspired you to pursue a career in this particular niche within the sports industry? I know you touched on it a little bit, but why sports for you?
Why sport? It's simple, and it can sound a bit, let's say, too simplistic, but it's really the case. I mean, as a kid, I was crazy about football, and you know, even my family, even my friends really noticed at some point that my level of passion for football was more than the normal watching a match on Saturday evening or Sunday afternoon or the Champions League on Tuesday evening. It was much more than that. It was about reading about that. So when internet came out, we're talking about the beginning of 2000, I started to, you know, surf through sport and football websites. Everything for me was obviously new. And before that, I used to buy magazines, newspapers, ask my dad to buy me the stickers, you know, the famous Panini stickers about the Serie A, the Italian league players. So a lot of small details that made me think at some point growing up that why shouldn't this be my job? I mean, why should I start being, I don't know, an engineer or a lawyer if I'm not really passionate about that? So I think that having a passion and nurturing it really helps you growing up, because at the end of the day, you have a goal. And that's what happened to me. So I wasn't, I couldn't be sure that I would make it. And I will tell you a nice story, Karim, because when I was 19, 20, so my first or second year at university, I had a trip to Milan with some friends. We went to a club, Milan, as you might know, is a very, very famous for its nightlife and the likes. So we went to a club, and by obviously complete chance, I saw an agent, a football agent that was also at that party. So I approached him. I mean, none of my friends knew him. None of my friends knew him. I was the only one to recognize him. So shyly, I approached him. I introduced myself. I told him what I was studying, and I told him that I wanted to start to work in football. I didn't know if I wanted to become an agent or a consultant or whatever. His answer was a question, and his question was, "Who is your father?" And I told him that, well, my father was back then a lawyer, now he's retired, but he didn't know anyone in the football industry at all, but like by no means. And he was like, "Well, then if that's the case, I give you 10% of chances to make it." So he was with this, I would say, arrogant attitude, and, you know, not even looking at my eyes when we were talking. He was really like, you know, in a way, killing my hopes, because, you know, if I don't know anyone, if my relatives are not into any, I don't know, any political lobby or anything like that, then you basically have, 10%, maybe threw a number just to make me happy that it's not zero, you know. So for me, it was tough. Was tough. I still remember that. And I basically couldn't enjoy the whole night, even though we were in a very nice nightclub in Milan. But you know, it was a bit of a stimulus that he gave me unconsciously to say, look, I mean, this guy, he doesn't even know me. So he just thinks that, you know, if you're the son of this or that, especially, you know, the Italian mindset, very, very typical, unfortunately, then you cannot become anyone. So, and most of all, you cannot pursue your dreams. So, you know, I kept on working hard, kept on doing my studies back then. And then again, the master's in London, and then the opportunity came up, and here I am. Of course, there is still a lot to do, a lot to grow. I mean, I haven't reached any pinnacle at all, but I mean, already for a few years, I'm in the industry, and that's where I want to be, and where I want to be for the time being.
For sure, that's a great story. I'm so grateful that you've shared that one. I've experienced similar experiences that you've experienced, and it feels so good once you've accomplished your goal of what you wanted to, as you have, you're in. So it must be an amazing feeling for yourself. How many years have you been with Football Benchmark?
It's considering also the years at KPMG now, it's a bit more than 8 years. Wow. So it's like 8 years and a half. So this has been my only professional experience, because I joined there and then I stayed until, again, we left KPMG in 2022 and we started to work on our own. So yeah, that's the time frame.
Nice. Almost a decade, almost 10 years. I mean, Antonio, kudos to you, man. I tip my hat off to you. Congratulations. And you obviously, you know, proven that person wrong. So that story definitely probably gave you a fueling fire in your stomach.
Indeed.
And got to make it now.
It did. As I told you, it was a big, I mean, the evening was bad. But then from the following day or a couple of days later, after I digested the whole experience, of course, it was a 1 minute and a half conversation. So literally like this in a club, imagine soft lights, high music, you know, this kind of situation. So I didn't have a coffee with that man. But anyways, it was definitely a fuel to the fire. And I mean, it's not many people know this story, by the way. So it's I think it was a crucial point for me, definitely.
For sure. Thank you for sharing. Football Benchmark is known for its comprehensive analysis of football club economics. Could you share with us how the platform has evolved over the years and its impact on the football community?
Yeah, thank you, Karim, because I think it's useful for your audience to understand who we are and what we do. So we have two main, let's say, business lines. One is the one you just mentioned, so our data and analytics platform. It's a platform that has been built since basically the weeks I joined back then, so in 2015. And of course, it has evolved massively ever since. So in this platform, in a nutshell, we collect economic and financial information of more than 300 football clubs in the world, commercial deals around the world, everything about football clubs. Player valuations estimated, so player market values estimated through our own proprietary algorithms, social media figures, and much more. The platform is continuously evolving. Every year we try to add new features, add new verticals. We have launched something recently in relation to player salaries as well, for example. So that's one of our business lines. And basically clients can access these platforms through a subscription. When I mean clients, I'm referring to football clubs, football leagues, federations, football agents, investors, some also from the US, obviously, academic institutions, media outlets, and so on and so forth. Our second, other business line is the pure advisory services. So we work for this portfolio of clients that I told you now, but rather than providing access, in other cases, we are involved in the, traditional strategic financial consultancy. So business planning, valuation, feasibility studies, market studies. So I'll give you a couple of concrete examples. A football club wants to build a new stadium. We do a market and feasibility study in relation to how much, first of all, the stadium should be big. So attendance analysis, how big the stadium should be, how much it should cost, how much revenues it will generate, how much OPEX also it will cost, and what will be the return on the investment. Or an investor X wants to buy a football club Y in Europe, and we do due diligence, transaction support, and valuation. We also value the football club, the target club in question, so that the investor can have, a clue, an understanding before any negotiation that clearly, obviously takes place finally for the final price to be agreed upon. But at least he or she or they have in mind a starting point, a value, a numerical value that can drive then those negotiations forward. So these are some of the examples of the projects with which I'm involved on a daily basis.
Understood. When we talk about investment opportunity, do you guys only focus on Europe, or do you guys also help investors international on an international scale? In regards to investment opportunity in the U.S., is an investor able to come to you guys for those numbers of a feasible study and so on and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely, because we have done we have worked with clients from Canada to Colombia to Israel to Egypt to Pakistan. So we are a multinational company. So definitely, the answer is definitely yes. At the end of the day, these skills and this expertise that we clearly mostly apply, I would say, in Europe, because at the end of the day, we all know that European soccer is the most developed, can be applied anywhere. So Middle East is a hot market nowadays. And again, I gave you some other examples. So Africa, Asia, the Americas, even Oceania. We worked also with an Oceanian client. So definitely something that we can assist our clients almost anywhere in the world.
I have some interesting questions to get your thoughts on. If you had the option to buy or launch a new club, would you buy an existing club or launch a new club? And where would you buy or build?
Well, this is a question for the American market, because in Europe to found a new club is, I wouldn't say it's impossible. You can do it, but then to start from the football pyramid in Europe is huge. You have every country is different, more or less. But if I think about Italy, there are 3 professional tiers and maybe other 6 or 7 amateur. So you would have to climb 10 tiers to get to the first division if you found a club tomorrow morning, let's say. And it's also difficult because the fan base is already, subdivided. So to create a football club and have someone support that football club is very, very difficult. In the US, it's different. So there are the so-called expansion franchises, right, which are founded, I would say, from zero or from old franchises. So that the topic is very different. Now, would it be in the US the case better to found a new club or to buy an existing one? I think it's a matter also of money, because nowadays the ticket, let's say, for purchasing MLS or even second or third the US division franchises is booming. Not mentioning the other American sports with the NFL, the NBA, not even mention that. So it's a matter also of cost benefits in terms of, do I have $200-$500 million to buy a club or franchise, I don't know where in the US, and possibly further grow that value. So then when I have an exit, I can make a profit. Or is it, let's say, more prudent or more sustainable, viable to found it from scratch? So with a definitely lower investment, and then possibly jump into the top higher divisions in order to increase the value. Or as there is no promotion and relegation, eventually being able to found a club, a franchise, and then try to, let's say, lobby to the MLS. I mean, this is, you know, it's also a political topic. So now there are, what is it, 30 franchises in the MLS, Karim? How many are they?
I think so. Around there. They just recently launched the San Diego franchise.
And I was saying San Diego, and I think there is another one coming up in 1 or 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. By the way, the MLS is also one of our clients. So I don't think that it's so straightforward to add the franchise to the MLS, but maybe you can do it at the lower levels, and maybe you can, let's say, focus on player development. So you then sell your players to the MLS clubs, and this is a way somehow to also increase the value of your club, even if you are not allowed, because again, there is a closed system, so you cannot technically be promoted to the MLS, right? So there could be different angles, different strategies at the end of the day to be explored.
100%. So, you know, talking about the North America market versus the European market, completely different. The European market, you could buy into an existing club. Well, that's kind of like the only option per se, because there's too many clubs. You buy into an existing club, and then the opportunity for promotion relegation is there. Obviously, you want the club to get promoted if you're starting from, let's say, Division 4 or Division 3, and you want to go higher.
Exactly.
That prize money. And then in regards to the North American market, there's the opportunity to invest and launch your own club. With saying that, I don't think you answered my question. What would you do? Would you go to North America?
It's a difficult question, because I would have to, let's say, it's a case by case. I should assess the specific opportunity. I mean, should I buy a club, I don't know, in which state of the US, which maybe, I mean, maybe this club is not having the best seasons in the past few years. The fan base is depressed. So maybe the owner is willing to divest, and it could be a bit of a bargain. Or should I found a club in a state where there is not any soccer, so that possibly I can tap into that market also from a sport perspective, because maybe they have NFL, maybe they have football, maybe they have baseball, but they don't have soccer. And possibly my analysis shows me that there is some hunger for soccer there. Then founding a club there, or again a franchise, could make sense. So I cannot provide a unique answer.
Okay, well, I'll leave it at that then. I was interested to get your thought on that. Okay, cool. So, you know, that I'll just share this quickly before I ask the next question. So at One Soccer Nation, you know, I've really studied the U.S. landscape, and you know, again, you're just really stamping it here. You're verifying it for me in regards to the investment to launch a new club. Is only really in North America. It's really hard to do in Europe. I'm not too sure about Africa, but that gets me really excited about the US because of the Copa America, which is coming up in June, the 2026 World Cup, which is going to be hosted by US, Canada, Mexico, and then possibly a FIFA Women's World Cup in the US. So lots of hype, lots of eyeballs and attention going towards the US. So very exciting. With saying that, throughout your career, you've worked with a wide range of football clubs, and organizations. Can you highlight one project or client interaction that particularly stands out to you and why?
Yeah, that's a nice question because, of course, many projects, many memories. I could remember one project that referred also to a trip that I had, a client visit, which was in Israel. This gave me the opportunity to check and visit Jerusalem, which was an incredible experience. Leaving aside the political situation in place now, I'm referring to the beauty of the city, the culture, the three religions living next to each other in that city. Honestly, it was something that was impressive. So I remember that trip, especially for, let's say, for the personal and cultural visits. The client visit was all good. The client actually was not in Jerusalem, but it was an Israeli football club. From a pure, let's say, professional standpoint, definitely a project with one of the biggest associations, football associations, where a lot of politics was involved. So it was about the launch of a new league, and we really had a lot of headaches because on almost a daily basis, they were contacting us and we needed to scratch all the notes from the previous day and need to rethink again because we needed to change direction again. And they were, let's say, pushing into a specific direction, but then it's also a matter of integrity. So that's the risk that many times you run when working for a client that wants to somehow influence your output, right? Your strategy. So they pay your bills, that's true, but we still need to maintain our integrity because otherwise we would totally lose credibility, right? So, but it's easier said than done sometimes because in the middle of the project, hands-on, having direct relationship with the client again, almost on a daily basis, you need to say some no's, some big no's, and the client might be pissed. So it's sometimes an interesting fight, quote unquote. So that's where again the experience, the professionalism at the end of the day of each of us has to stand out. And at the end of the day, it's always a matter of finding a halfway solution. So that the client happiness is always the final goal, but also that we manage to keep definitely our integrity. So that project, which was I think 2 years ago, one of the first projects after we left KPMG, it was long, it was tiring, it was stressful, challenging, but for these specific reasons, one of the best projects I've ever worked on.
Amazing. Valuation plays a crucial role in understanding the financial landscape of football clubs. How do you approach the valuation process, especially considering the dynamic nature of the industry?
Yeah, we are recognized as one of the biggest experts in the valuation sector in football. We started to position ourselves thanks to some marketing initiatives when in 2016, so like literally 2-3 months after I joined, we published our first report, which became our flagship report, a thought leadership named the European Elite, where we estimate the enterprise value of the 32 most prominent European football clubs. So that report helped us in positioning into this sector. And indeed, from that report publication, the first year and the following years, and this year we will do it again around the spring, beginning of summertime. We have done many projects in that space. So valuation of football clubs is tricky, and we could speak 2 hours about that, because valuing a company that has that generates profit is one thing. A listed company where all the numbers are disclosed and everyone knows about their situation, their share price is one thing. Valuing football clubs, which are not so, let's say, friendly with disclosure, which are not so, let's say, profit generating, rather the opposite, I would say, makes the whole exercise more challenging. There are obviously the typical and traditional, I would say, approaches of corporate finance that can be applied to valuation of football club. I'm thinking about a discounted cash flow, But not all of them, for the reasons I've mentioned, can be applied. So without getting into the details of approaches and methodology, because I mean there is discounted cash flow, there is net asset valuation, there is the revenue multiple valuation. So again, different approaches. It's always the thing is always to understand at the outset what is the best approach to use for that specific club, because one thing is also to value Real Madrid, and one thing is to value a Spanish third division club. So there is not one fits all methodologies. There is not one fits all strategy. There is also the client requirements. There is also the client budget. So these are all factors that affect whenever we are tasked to undertake a valuation, factors to take into account before then venturing into the specific exercise.
Understood. With saying that, switching gears here, 2020, COVID happened. From your perspective, how has the COVID-19 pandemic affected the financial strategies and operations of football clubs? And what adaptations do you foresee in the future if another COVID-19 comes, something along those lines, maybe similar or worse, or maybe not as bad?
Well, we hope something similar won't happen anymore, Karim, first of all, because otherwise we are going to be challenged hardly a lot again. But and I'm not referring to professional, but also to personal, obviously, life. Well, how were football clubs affected? They were heavily affected. I'm always referring mostly to European football, also because, again, this is where some figures are available. Actually, many figures are available. MLS franchises do not publish their accounts, so I cannot have a clear picture about that. But in relation to European soccer, European football, clubs' figures and existence were really jeopardized. So two main issues: lack of liquidity, lack of cash, because even the owners' own businesses were affected. So even the rich owners that were used to, let's say, cover losses with capital, with equity, couldn't do it anymore, because even their own business was hampered, was at risk. So stadiums were closed. So people were not going to the stadium, which means that stadium revenues were basically null. Commercial revenues were basically null, because again, who would buy merchandising? Which company would commit on a multi-year contract in such an uncertain scenario, right? So every income source plummeted, and also the player trading revenues, so the revenues deriving from the player, from the trading of players between clubs, also plummeted, because again, no one could afford to buy a player. Indeed, what we witnessed was a surge in loans. So many loans and player swaps. This is what happened, especially in 2020, 2021. Then from 2022, we all witnessed also in our personal lives that we were coming back to a degree of normalcy. So people were, fans were starting to be allowed again in the stadiums. So clubs could start to generate again money from gate receipts. The commercial sector as well also recovered. Players again started to, let's say, to circulate and be bought or sold for money, and not just for free loans. So this somehow then from 2022 helped clubs to go back to normalcy. And we witnessed now the latest 2022-2023 financial statements are out, and we are witnessing for some clubs level of revenues and profitability which are outpacing those pre-COVID as well. So this really tells us that the industry has come back to a degree of normalcy.
Understood. Yeah, I don't want to see another COVID-19 ever again. But
please not, Karim. Please not.
I want to ask a fun question here. Who's your favorite football club?
Juventus in Italy.
Got it. What about favorite player?
I don't have one. When I was a kid, I used to like a few players, not necessarily playing in my team, because as I said, I was from the very beginning literally watching matches also outside of my own favorite team when the pay TV and again internet started to become more popular. Nowadays, really, I'm trying to think about that. I don't think that I have a favorite player. No, not really.
Yeah. You know, football is not just a sport, but it's a global behemoth. And it's the most watched sport. We got, when the World Cup comes on, we have 2 billion plus fans watching the game. In your opinion, what are some key factors driving the globalization of football, and how does this impact the business aspect of the game?
Well, football is the most popular sport, I think, because it's easy to play, easy to replicate. So the popularity of football, in my opinion, is given by the fact that from the rich to the poor, everyone can play it. So if you have a ball or something that is round and bounces, if you have a jacket or a tree that you can make the posts out of that, and I'm telling you my experience from when I was a kid, like we didn't used to play at 5, 6, or 7 in official pitches, right? So you would play in gardens, you would play in parks, you would play in garage sometimes. And the door of the garage would be the goal, or in a park, a tree would be a post, and a plant would be the other post, and that's a goal straight away. So that allows you to play easily from Canada to Africa to Europe to literally anywhere, and that obviously makes that kids grow up and love the football and love the sport. Plus, obviously, there is the component of the dads of the family that have also a football culture somehow, and of course bring it to the youngsters, right? So I think that most of us who support a club, there is because our father or our uncle or our grandfather or our mother supported a specific club, and then this is how you started to support as well. So there is also a kind of inheritance, right, in the culture. In relation to the globalization, so I think this is about the popularity. Then globalization with pay-per-view and with football clubs becoming a true global entertaining brands. That's made, you know, Manchester United is touring every summer in Asia. PSG goes to the US. Manchester City goes to Middle East. So it's not anymore a local sport where the local fan supports the local club. Nowadays, I'm referring to these big clubs. They are supported anywhere. I'm sure that Manchester United has much more fans, many more fans abroad than in the UK, but by far. So that's why today there is not anymore the football pitch. There is it's a universal ground given by OTT platforms, by again pay TV. Chinese, Japanese, Indian, Indonesian fans can watch Manchester United anytime they want. They just need to pay a subscription, or again on their tablet or on their TV. So that really made football have the next step. How does this compare to American sports? Well, American sport franchises are still valued more than football clubs in Europe. Why is it possible if football is the most popular and blah, blah, blah? Because in Europe you have, first of all, there is still a lower degree of professionalization compared to the US. Many football clubs are partially or were in some cases still run like family businesses. So this is really now becoming only for the top clubs, more professional, but more and more are following up. In the US, this is really not the case. And because in the US, there is a closed system where there is no threat of relegation. So any investor that buys an MLS franchise, an NBA franchise, an NFL franchise, and so on and so forth, knows that they will play in the NFL, they will play in the MLS forever. there is no relegation risk. There is nothing that can happen that will hamper their cash flows, basically. In Europe, you can one season, you can play Champions League. The following season, you do a couple of, let's say, bad acquisitions on the market, and you go to the second division. And your business plan, you need to throw it out of the window. So that makes European football somehow maybe more entertaining. I don't know. It depends on the perspectives, actually. But on the other hand, there is a much higher degree of risk. And that's obviously taken into account whenever there is a transaction. So that's why, again, the NFL, the NBA, especially NFL and NBA franchises are valued to date much more than the Manchester United or the Paris Saint-Germain of the situation. But I think that gap can be narrowed, but as things stand nowadays, cannot be closed, because another crucial factor is financial sustainability. American sports have a hard or soft salary cap. This is not the case in Europe. So you can literally lose 200-300 million pounds every year. There are some regulations that are becoming stricter and stricter, so don't get me wrong, but nowhere near what is happening in the US. And for an investor, this is another, let's say, red flag that you need to consider if you want to invest in the sector.
Absolutely. A lot of great points there, Antonio. You know, again, the North American market is completely different to the European market. Two completely different beasts. With saying that, what are your thoughts on, how do you feel about social media? You know, there's so much content now. How do you feel about, you know, where we're going with social media? And then we'll dive into the tech.
Well, social media nowadays they have replaced newspapers, right? And even websites. I mean, even the pure internet and the pure news and websites. I mean, nowadays we follow almost everything on TikTok and Instagram and X and so on and so forth, right? So now the matter about football clubs is to capitalize on that. So again, you can have a fan in Indonesia, but can you really capitalize on him or her? So can you engage with him or her? And if so, how? So and that's why I was saying before, again, especially for big clubs, they have become true big global entertainment brands, but somehow even, I would say, media houses. I mean, they post loads of contents on a single day, on a daily basis, on all of their platforms. So this is where nowadays, and of course, social media are also starting to become streaming platforms, right? Where you can watch matches. So it's a matter of capitalizing. It's a matter of using it properly, because it's also true that social media also have a flip side of the coin, so that they can become somehow tricky, let's say, tricky tools, and they could somehow fire back at you. But with proper usage and I would say a proper strategy as well, this is really the next step for football clubs to grow.
For sure. What about tech? Like, do you think that we're getting to a place where there's too much technology being used, or we're not there yet?
In European football, not at all, Karim. European football is still very traditional. I mean, I know many stadiums where, you know, you still have to bring the printed ticket like 30 years ago. So then again, Real Madrid is different, but football is not only Real Madrid, Manchester United and Paris Saint-Germain, right? So we are not there yet. We are not there yet at all. In Europe, it's still not there. Then, of course, it depends on the areas, on the countries, on the markets, but not at all. Of course, there are new techs. I'm thinking about artificial intelligence. I'm talking about VR. So some clubs are starting also to capitalize on that. For example, I know a friend who has a company whose business is to provide VR experiences to fans. So you buy some big glasses, and you can, let's say, pretend to be in the Camp Nou in Barcelona during the pre-match routine of the Barcelona players. So, you know, it's always a matter of then staying ahead with technology. I'm thinking about crypto, which is another source of income, and which has become a new source of income, a recent source of income for football clubs. I'm thinking about VR. I'm thinking about AI. So again, it's a matter of staying up to date, trying to capitalize on these. Not many clubs have the structure to capitalize on everything. Many football clubs, people would be surprised, but even some big clubs have really a small structure, a thin structure where only a few people are really the decision makers. So there is not really much, I would say, even human resources, human capital to then exploit these new potential initiatives or new technologies in this case. So that's also needs to be taken into account. So it's not European football is one, but the reality is that there are many different layers between clubs, between leagues. So it's difficult, let's say, to have a unique answer in that sense.
Understood. I know we're a bit over time here. Do you have a few minutes to answer two more questions?
Let's try to, yes. Karim, yeah, let's try to be quick, but yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard that one in a long time. Rapido, that's quick, fast. Football Benchmark provides insights into player valuations as well. What are some key metrics or factors you consider when assessing the value of a football player in today's market?
Well, we start from two big pools of data. One is the past transactions, so thousands of transfer fees paid for actual transactions that occurred on the market. And the second big pool of data is the current sporting performances. Then what we also look at are other, let's say, off-pitch metrics such as age, such as contract duration, which is crucial, which is commercial, let's say, value in the sense of social media followers and engagement, because nowadays football players are not only purchased for what they bring on the pitch, but also for what they can bring off the pitch. Think about merchandising opportunities or, let's say, tapping into new markets that maybe that specific club really is not really present before that acquisition. So these are some of the key metrics, and then we put everything together in a general linear regression model, which then gave us initially a unique output, but then we understood that it wouldn't be the case to value goalkeepers with the same metrics used for forwards. So basically, and finally, we developed one algorithm for the goalkeepers, one for the defenders, one for the midfielders, and one for the forwards.
Understood. And the last question I have here is, reflecting on your journey so far, what advice would you give to aspiring professionals that want to get into the sports space, specifically actually the sports advisory sector within football?
Well, definitely a background in economics or finance is useful. So that's, I wouldn't say a must, because in life you never know, but definitely a plus, let's put it this way. I've known people also from engineering or from law as well, although from law you can do also, let's say, law consultancy. That's not my case. But definitely economics and finance are the most common. It's not easy, although nowadays there are, compared to also to the times when I did my master, there are many more masters in relation to football and sport, and I think that this definitely could provide a further plus, because again, it really gives on the CV a straight direction into the sport industry. Languages are helpful for what we said at the beginning, because besides the personal experience, I mean, knowing languages allows to be able to speak to clients of different cultures. And then for a fresh graduate, it's always also about soft skills. So passion, enthusiasm, willingness to learn, flexibility, because especially in consultancy, there could be tough schedules and tough weekends. I would say willingness and flexibility also to relocate. I'm always a bit, let's say, skeptic when I speak to to young people that maybe live in, I don't know, Paris or Milan or London, and they say that they want to look for a job in their specific city? I mean, of course, you can start from there. I wouldn't say no, but open yourself to other destinations, because of course this gives you more opportunities, no? Then you are always on time after a few years to go back home, but you should always explore. You should always somehow throw yourself, especially when you are very young and you shouldn't have any, let's say, big personal or family commitments, right? So these are, I would say, some basic, but some hopefully useful advice that I can give.
Amazing. Well, Antonio, thank you so much for taking the time for joining us on the Wanna Talk Nation podcast today.
Thank you, Karim, again for hosting me, and to your audience for listening to me.